Hi, I'm Ingrid Kohler.
And I'm Jonathan Carr-West.
Welcome to LGIU Fortnightly.
Ingrid, it's great to be back. I haven't done this for a few weeks now, so
yeah.
It's always a pleasure.
We've got an audience today as well.
We do. We're live broadcasting, but in our respective houses to our respective bemused families. But they're going to finish this with insights into local government that they didn't have before, and they will be all the richer for it.
I believe so. Yeah, absolutely. I can't see eyes glazing over at all. But we know you, our dear listeners, will be interested, and we've got a really, really good show. Some big things are happening.
It's been quite a week in local government land, hasn't it? We've been busy. We've been working with quite intensively with one of our members, helping them think about their post-COVID service transformation plans, which has been a really fascinating process.
Exhausting.
It's quite tiring, yeah. But I mean, just doing it online is quite. I mean, the online facilitation is new to us, and I think really good in many ways, but also slightly surprisingly to me, even harder than doing it face to face. It's really, really hard work.
Yeah, it's been a learning process for us, but I mean, I think we've captured lessons and turned it around quite quickly, if I do say so myself.
Look, people aren't tuning in to hear us moan about having to work hard, because they're all working hard too. And that's what they expect. But it has been a really interesting process. What's really struck me, and I've been working with several councils actually on these, either on some service transformation post-COVID or on their sort of COVID recovery groups. And there are some interesting consistencies coming up, I think. And what really strikes me is that throughout the sector, or certainly everyone I've spoken to, there's this real sense of a moment and where you have to seize the opportunity for change. So people are very clear that, you know, a terrible pandemic has impacted, you know, I mean, obviously, the biggest impact of it is the loss of life for tens of thousands of people and the impact on their families. But there's also a massive economic impact. There's also a massive impact on councils in terms of the demand for services, in terms of their ability to respond to that, in terms of their income and their finances. But also a very clear sense that, you know, this means we have to change what we do. And there is a moment here that we have to seize to make those changes. And if we let that pass, you know, that could be, and, you know, one of the things that struck me is how people are talking about this as a really existential moment. So, you know, people saying, if we don't seize this moment, you know, someone used the phrase, you know, stagnation and death spiral. You know, there's this real sense that actually this is a really, really, really important time where we have to think about how we deliver services, how we run the council, what the council is, how we respond to the needs of our community. And if we don't change, and people in every council I've worked with have said things like, you know, business as usual is not an option. Doing nothing is not an option. The biggest risk of all is not to change. Going backwards it would be the worst thing we could do. You know, business, you know, going back to the world as we thought it was pre-COVID is just not a viable option. And that, I've yet to hear anyone demurring from that. I mean, there seems to be an almost complete consensus around that, which I think is really fascinating, because we haven't seen that before. You know, we didn't see that, for example, post 2008 in the financial crash. We didn't see that, not so consistently and not all at once, as councils had to deal with massive spending cuts through a decade of austerity. That affected different people at different times to different extents. You know, and lots of people saying, right, we need to change, but not this sort of single all-in-one kind of moment to people going, right, wow, things have got to be different. And that, you know, I think we're only beginning to kind of understand that and what that means, and we'll all have to respond to it very, very quickly.
Talking to councils up and down the land and around the world, indeed, I think it's shown that councils have responded and have changed the way that they do business. And there's a real sense that momentum has to keep going. Like, we can't let our foot off the gas, so to speak. But there is a big risk. There is a big risk for councils in England, specifically around the money.
Sure. And, you know, this week we saw Robert Jenrick popping up virtually at the virtual LGA conference. I mean, I'd be interested in it. We will never, I doubt he'll tell us this, but, you know, secretaries of state have occasionally got a bit of a rough ride at LGA conference over the years.
That's true.
I wonder whether Robert Jenrick felt that it was easier or harder doing it virtually than being in the room with hundreds of angry councillors.
I wonder what the comment section was like.
Absolutely. But look, it was an important moment because he announced more money. You know, as we've been saying over the last few months, COVID-19 has presented an existential financial challenge to local government. You know, and listeners will be all too aware of this. Councils have had to do things to respond, you know, new activities to respond to the pandemic, delivering food parcels or whatever it may be, helping shielded people, whatever it may be. Councils have seen demand for some of their other services, domestic violence support, mental health support rise. And at the same time, we've seen this sort of catastrophic impact on council income, deferred council tax, long-term impact on business rates, but also, you know, people not parking in the town centre, people not going to the swimming pool, people not putting in planning applications. Yeah, and the sector as a whole has been saying, look, this is just, you know, again, an existential threat. And, you know, lots of people muttering about Section 114 notices. And now,
More than muttering.
Yeah, yeah, sure. Warning that they're imminent. And the government's position has been, look, we've given you a bunch of cash, given, you know, pre this week about, you know, 1.2 billion that allowed deferment of business rates. But, you know, they've done stuff. The government's position seemed to be, look, we'll, you know, having originally at the beginning of the pandemic said, you know, whatever it takes, we'll back you up, seemed to be saying, yeah, look, we'll pay you for the stuff that we've asked you to do, the extra stuff we've asked you to do. You know, we've recognized that you know, doing stuff comes at a cost, and, you know, if we want you to do extra stuff, we should pay for it. I mean, it's taken them a while to recognize that, but, yeah, great. But really cagey about meeting lost income. What we saw this week was, you know, Robert Jenrick said, look, here's another 500 million cash, but also for the first time accepting the principle that government should compensate councils for some of that lost income. So I think 75% after the first 5% of lost
income. What does that even mean?
Well, I mean, financially savvier brains than mine have been poring over the small print of this ever since he announced this. I think, you know, the sector's response as a whole, I think, could be summed up as a bit of a sort of, well, yeah, too little, too late. And I think that's probably fair. You know, most of the people within the sector I was going to say that this is a drop in the ocean. It's just not enough. I think, to, you know, if we wanted to be fair to the government, I think it is important that at least the principle of compensating for lost income has been recognized, because now we can have an argument about whether it's enough or not. Whereas if they're just not going to do it, that's harder to do. But it's very hard to see that this money is gonna meet the need. And for me, the really important point is, it's not just the argument about whether it's enough money or not. The point is, it's all kind of reactive. It's just sort of sticking plus. It's after the fact. Oh, council's massively exposed. Let's put a bit of money in, try and patch it together again. You know, it's responsive. It's too, you know, not, I think it is important that not only is it too little, it is also too late. And the reason it's too late is because it's all happening in this strategic vacuum, because we don't know how local government is financed on an ongoing basis. You know, we don't know what percentage of business rates we're meant to retain. We don't know what the Fairer Funding Review will come up with as a sort of formula for redistribution. We're financed through, you know, ad hoc one-year settlements. So you're trying to make these decisions about how you support councils in a time of extraordinary need in a complete sort of vacuum. You know, and no one could have foreseen COVID. No one could have seen this impact coming. But we would have been in a much better position to deal with it if we were operating on firm foundations. And instead, we're on shaky foundations. Indeed, we're on no foundations. And then we're inevitably playing catch up and playing kind of, you know, I mean, the PM likes to talk about whack-a-mole, but yeah, that's essentially what we're doing. Oh, there's a problem. We need to throw some money. Well, of course. Why aren't we anticipating? Why aren't we saying, look, what is a stable and secure way of funding local government or letting local government fund itself? And then it's much easier to say, okay, what variation now is occurring from this crisis, and how do we sort of align that? But you have the basis to do that because you know what you're doing in the first place. If you've just, you know, when you have a situation that breeds massive uncertainty, if you're building that on existing uncertainty, you're just multiplying the problem. So it is an immediate problem of, is this enough money to fix where we are right now? But it's a much bigger problem, long-term problem, that actually we don't have a settled constitutional view of what local government is for and how we should be funding it. And that has been exposed.
Absolutely. And I think, we've been talking about it. We're going to hear a little bit later from Gavin Callahan. He's the leader at Basildon. He talks about exactly these points and how this financial uncertainty is affecting them. And as they try to plan for recovery and even plan for, you know, potentially second waves and new spikes, as we've seen in Leicester this week, where again, uncertainty around data and information, so not just the money, but just even what's going on in your local area, is coming up because council staff, council leaders have been telling us, either, you know, privately or publicly now more, they're not even getting the data about what's happening about active COVID cases in their local area.
Yeah. There was a tweet that was widely shared from Lord Porter, you know, friend of LGAU and former chairman of the LGA, just being very explicit about this, right? Public, you know, on the record saying, to be absolutely clear, we have not been given all the data. Yeah, we've had the Pillar 1 data. I've asked for the Pillar 2 data. We're not getting it. We don't have a complete picture of what's going on in our localities. And look, you know, sharing data is free. You know, accumulating data, it can be expensive and difficult and hard. But once you've got it, sharing it with the people who really need it shouldn't be difficult.
Not sharing it has a huge cost. A
huge cost, for sure. But look, you know, despite this uncertainty, councils have to move forward, and we do need to think about what it is that councils do as we move into a recovery period, and how we change the operations of local government. You know, that theme that we started with, the people saying this is, you know, however difficult this moment is, it is going to drive change, and it must make us do things differently. And so we need to support that. So one of the other things that's happened this week in LGIU world is we've launched the first really detailed pillar of our post-COVID councils work, talking about sustainable futures.
So we're looking not just at sustainable futures, which we'll tell you about in just a second, but we're also looking at location of power, place and community, unfinished business, because there is a lot of things that we still need to address, including adult social care, finance, all the kind of issues of constitutional purpose of local government and what residents and users need from councils, trust and governance, and bringing it all together with a theme that we call toward a new municipalism, which is a theme that we've explored in the past.
Absolutely. And I think there's a, you know, there's a narrative that runs through that, you know. What have we seen from the experience of the last few months? We've seen that we need to think differently about where decisions are made. We need to think about how we emerge from this in a sustainable way. You know, what it means for the places we live in and the communities that we're part of. But also, as you say, picking up those issues like finance that are unfinished. how we do all that in a way that imbues that the public will buy into and trust, and what councils need to be, what sort of organizations they need to be to enable all of that. So it's really important that we address those questions, but we wanted to begin with, because it's driven by our members are so that the one we really want to engage with is thinking about how we make decisions that build us a more sustainable, a fairer, a better future. It's not about building, you know, people talk a lot about building back better, don't they? It's not about just trying to get back to December 2019. It's about trying to emerge with something that's more resilient. And that's clearly, yeah, an issue of vital importance to all of us. Ingrid, tell us a little bit more about what the Sustainable Futures Workstream is going to involve.
Well, as we've seen throughout this crisis, local has been the way that we've been dealing with things. From providing millions of meals and supporting communities, helping vulnerable individuals, councils have made unimaginable things happen so quickly. So while these amazing things have happened, I think one of the other things that's really happened is that COVID-19 has highlighted some of the unfairness and some inequalities in our existing society and some problems that we've already had and knew about, but just has either promised us a new and better future, like in terms of environmental sustainability or sustainable transport, or has highlighted issues around income and racial inequality or gender inequality, you know, all kinds of things. So as we plan for recovery, we've got to really think about what's fair, what's the kind of society that we want to be. We've got this moment in time to do that, but it's going to require deep thinking, but fast thinking, or else we're going to go back to an old, worse normal. So this theme is really all about thinking through and working with our member councils and other partners to think about what that fairer future could look like and how we can actually put the blocks in place to achieve it.
Fantastic. And of course, this isn't about us, what we think. It's about you, our members, and what you think. So we really want to hear from you about this, and indeed about all the strands of our post-COVID councils work. You can read all about them, and you can sign up to be part of them at lgru.org. And on the Sustainable Future strand, we will be kicking off our member engagement around that with a workshop on the 5th of August. So you can go to the website, and if you want to come to that virtual Zoom workshop, you can register online at lgru.org, and we'd love to have as many of you there as possible so that we can begin that conversation about what a more sustainable future looks like as we plan the recovery stages from COVID-19. And of course, that's something that all councils are doing. And we talked at the beginning about, you know, we've been engaging with a lot of councils around their recovery planning. And Ingrid, this week you had an interview with Gavin Callaghan, leader of Basildon Council, who we've done, LGRU member, we've done quite a lot of work with Basildon over the past couple of years, which we've mentioned on the podcast before. And he had quite a lot to say about this very issue.
Absolutely. Let's hear from him.
I'm Councillor Gavin Callaghan, and I'm the leader of Basildon Borough Council.
Thanks for joining us. As I've been asking everyone, how has it been for you?
Well, it's certainly been a different challenge to what I was expecting back in March. I was one of those people who was expecting to be pounding the streets in order to get re-elected in May. So in some ways, it's obviously put the council elections off, which was nice not to have that hanging over your head. But unfortunately, the COVID crisis has come along and dominated, really. So since the 16th, 17th of March, it has been pretty much every day, 7 days a week, reacting, particularly at the beginning, to the lockdown, what was going on with the guidance, what residents were seeing, hearing, how we were communicating with businesses, how we were going to change the functions of the council so that our staff could work remotely and that councils could still make decisions. I was very conscious that I wanted councillors to still very much be involved in the decision-making process and to have a handle and a grip on as much information as possible. So making that work was a challenge. And it really has just been an opportunity, I think, to see local government at its absolute best after what has been a ridiculously challenging 10 years in terms of local government finance, to then be faced at that 10th anniversary with this global pandemic has been a real task. But I think local government has stepped up. I'm incredibly proud of all of my officers in Basildon and the leadership that has been shown by my chief exec and deputy chief exec. And I think the work we've done with partners over the last 10 years has really come to the fore during this, because we have been connected to our community in a way that I don't think any other branch of government is able to be. And that has meant, you know, frankly, before the Prime Minister even announced that we were in lockdown, we as an authority were delivering food parcels, we were delivering medicine parcels, we were doing that already before the lockdown came. And I don't think, as I say, other branches of government would have been able to do that. So, yes, it's been a challenge. Sadly, we have lost people in our borough to coronavirus. But I'm grateful for the work that the council has done, which I think has helped to save people's lives as well, and give people some reassurance that there will be life after coronavirus. And what that looks like is going to be up to all of us to determine. And hopefully we're in a position as a council to be given the power and the resources to put Basildon back together again in a way that sees us able to meet the challenges that COVID will obviously provide to our economy and to our businesses, but also see some of the opportunities that it will provide, particularly around regeneration and the catalyst for some of the change that we need around housing as well. So you never want to say that there's a good to come out of such a you know, devastating pandemic for so many people and so many families, but there has to be life after COVID. My job and the council's job is to figure out what that's going to look like. And we started doing that very quickly in this process, because that recovery is, yes, there's a public health recovery, but then there's going to be an economic one that has to come as well. And we need to be on that.
Absolutely. And that's what I mainly want to talk to you about today. But before we turn to that, actually, just some of the things that you said about being able to see that, you know, maybe not knowing what the lockdown would look like, but seeing that people were already in need, getting councillors involved. What do you think have been some of the key lessons that you've learned about yourselves as a community, as an organization, when you've been put to a test like this?
Well, you know, Basildon is a... It's a brilliant place, but it's also a funny old place. And it has been, we're the fifth economically most unequal borough in the whole of the UK. And that always presents challenges for us. We're a borough of five towns where four out of the five towns don't associate with one town. And that happens to be the town that is the name of the council. So that always causes a bit of friction and a bit of tension. And we're a borough that is a 72-73% leave borough. And, you know, the remain leave argument is never far away from the surface here. And if you listen to a lot of people over the last 5 or 6 years, they would tell you that Basildon is only really defined by its division. And I've never subscribed to that as a councillor and seeing what I do as council leader. And I think that what we have seen since coronavirus kicked in is a compassion about our borough that is there every single day. From the guy who stood up on the roundabout outside our hospital and clapped every single morning for 7 weeks as those nurses either finished shifts or started shifts at 7 o'clock in the morning. He was up there through to the 20,000 plus telephone calls that have been made to our sheltered housing and elderly residents over this period. To ensure that loneliness and social isolation wasn't something that that they were having to deal with on their own, but they had someone at the end of the phone. There's been a huge compassion about Basildon, and it goes back really, and not to get too sentimental about it, but You know, Basildon was created out of the Blitz. It was, you know, we're only 71 years old as a borough, or as a town rather. And, you know, that Blitz mentality has really come to the fore during this pandemic. And it has been great to see neighbours who had never previously spoken, getting in touch with each other on WhatsApp and other things. We've had Royal Ascot, we've had VE Day. We've had all of these things going on in streets all over the borough, and it's been fantastic. As a council, you know, I think what people have come to realise is that good government matters, and that you cannot, when, you know, maybe provocative, I don't know, but when a large amount of stock has been placed in rhetoric and in you know, treating complicated issues like they are simple issues that can just be, you know, swept under the carpet or blown over very quickly over the last sort of 4 or 5 years as a country. I think we've come to realise, haven't we, during this, that actually what we need is serious politicians who have got a grasp of the detail and who've got your best interests at heart and who are doing everything day and night to make sure that the local council is there on the end of the phone when someone can't get food and when they can't get medicine and when they need replacement batteries for hearing aids or whatever it might be. And the council in Basildon was organised and it was able to respond. And I think what that has done is it has restored a large amount of trust and confidence in the council from our public. And, you know, I take a lot of heart from that. And I think that it puts us in a strong position. It's trust that's been earned, and it's our job now to keep that trust and to keep in the recovery, engaging with the public in the way that we have. And, you know, I spend most evenings on Facebook Live talking to the people of Basildon about what we're doing. And that's been, you know, a great opportunity. I think we've had over 200,000 views of the Facebook videos. And
that's impressive. Yeah, wow.
It's been incredible, and people have really wanted to engage with the council. And I think the key thing for us is we have not been afraid, and I haven't been afraid each evening to front up to people and to say, I have no idea what the answer to that question is, but I'm going to go and find out, or I'll get you an answer, or I will get you a response. And we've been able to do that. And I think the public have responded to that, and I think that they've seen that we've tried our best. We haven't got everything right, I'm sure, but we've done all right, I think, and we want to move on now quickly to the recovery stage.
What does the recovery stage look like in Basildon?
So in the short term, obviously, we're still dealing with the public health crisis, and with what has gone on over the last week or so in Leicester, a primary concern is to make sure that there is no second spike in Basildon. And for us, that is a particularly acute issue because we have a hospital in the borough that deals with a lot of patients from outside of the borough who are coming into Basildon and who may have coronavirus and are being treated at the hospital. And lots of those staff then live in and around the borough. So I'm concerned about that. I'm also concerned that, you know, the reopening of the high streets, and then particularly this weekend with the pubs opening, that has been a concern for a long time for the environmental health team about how that is managed. So in the short term, it's about making sure we don't get that spike and we don't get a second lockdown. Going forward, we are kind of, our priority has to move from being looking at this as a public health challenge to looking at this as an economic challenge. There is reports on my desk that suggest that up to 16,000 jobs in the borough are vulnerable because of coronavirus. That would be hugely devastating for Basildon. And we want to make sure that we're doing everything we can, both in terms of lobbying central government, but also providing support locally and signposting people to employment locally so that we don't lose those jobs and we don't have people you know, back in kind of Thatcherite levels of unemployment, because that would be devastating, and we don't want that. And then it's about the transformation of the council. And I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that we probably went through 5 years of transformation in about 5 days. And the council, you know, parts of the council in Basildon that, you know, never thought possible signing off accounts and treasury management remotely, did it from 31 different places. with all of the officers all over in their homes able to sign off the account. So we've embraced that. But now, you know, thousands of people want to talk to us. There's a new demographic of people who have never, ever spoken to their council who want to talk to us. And they don't want to do it by ringing up the council or going down to the town hall. They want to do it on their iPad and their iPhone. And therefore, it's important that digital transformation is accelerated during this. And then similarly, you know, our corporate estate, what is going to happen with that? You know, do we need the corporate estate that we have, or is there alternative uses for it? We need to look at that. And then I would say that, you know, a key thing for me, and particularly for Basildon, is we are embarking and we are still pursuing this, a £1 billion regeneration of Basildon Town Centre that puts the arts and culture at the heart of what we are doing. I'm very, very clear. We have a huge theatre in Basildon, and I want it to survive, and I want it to come back, and I want those artists and those sound engineers and those front of house staff and makeup artists and everyone who relies on the arts in Basildon to have a future. And so we need a specific package for the recovery of the arts. And if the government won't do it, then the council will have to look at what we can do. And I don't have the answer to that right now, but we will need to work on that to make it possible. So everything is on the table, is what I'm saying to my officers. There is nothing that coronavirus can't touch in terms of how we put Basildon Council and Basildon Borough back together again. And if we take that approach, and if we are brave enough as members and as officers to not try to very quickly just return to the status quo, but we look at this and say, well, what can we do differently? It could be a brave new world for Basildon if we do that.
One of the things so at LGIU, I mean, as you know, but we've been working with you, you know, off and on for a number of years in terms of like reimagining what Basildon will look like. And I've only had a limited touch on that project myself. But from what I know about it, you know, it is a lot about talking to communities, understanding their needs, all that kind of, you know, bringing people with you to create a new vision. How is that shaping what you're planning for this next stage, this post-COVID world, or not really quite post-COVID, but, you know, learning to live with it.
Yeah, I mean, it's crucial, isn't it? Because, and again, when I talked about digital transformation, part of that is around consultation and about how we involve more people in the decision-making process. And, you know, we're currently looking at parishing as well in order to increase the amount of parishing and town councils that we have in Basildon so we can devolve more decisions to a more local level when it comes to town centres and high streets. And that came out of the work that the LGIU worked with us on a couple of years ago on something called the Breakthrough Basildon Commission. And what it told us is, you know, Basildon is a part of the world that is high on civic engagement, low on civic pride. You know, people here are not afraid to tell me what they think, but they are not necessarily able to tell me the top five things about Basildon. I mean, you know, one of the things I always say, and it surprises people, is that if you stood on Tower Bridge and you look east all the way down the River Thames to the end of Southend Pier, Basildon, north and south of the Thames estuary, is the largest economy, second only to Canary Wharf. This is a major, major economic powerhouse. You know, every person who drinks Costa coffee will have had their coffee beans roasted in Basildon. Our armed forces are using night vision goggles made in Basildon. The electric vehicles that people are driving from Ford Motors, the technology for that is made in Basildon. So there's so much good about this borough. But we have been so utterly rubbish at telling the story of Basildon that we haven't been able to even take our own people with us, let alone take new people with us. So part of my job since I became leader of the council back in 2017 is how do we work on brand Basildon? And actually, in a perverse way, coronavirus has helped us to talk more about what is good about Basildon. you know, that 40% of those nurses who've been working day and night to help people during the pandemic, they might be your next door neighbor. They live in the borough. They're doing great work in the borough, right the way through to the advanced manufacturing and tech companies that we have here. So, you know, that's what we're doing. We're working on Brand Basel. And the only way that it will work is not for me to sit in my ivory tower and tell people, but it's through constant consultation and dialogue with the public. And I have tried to be the most accessible leader Basildon's ever had, whether that is through Facebook Lives, whether it's through Zoom calls, you know, even opening up of retail recently. You know, we were holding Zoom calls 4 or 5 weeks ago with those retailers about how it was going to work, well before it became a fashionable thing to do in the news. And so we're having those conversations, we're talking to those stakeholders, and it's meaningful engagement. You know, they tell us they don't want something, we try and find that a solution. So there'll be a lot more of that, and I want more of that, because it won't work if people are not on board. So it's crucial.
I'm going to turn to, I mean, obviously we're a localist think tank, so we would say this, wouldn't we? But kind of question, how has the relationship been between central and local government? Have you had the information and the resources that you've needed?
It has been a challenge with central government. Everything from Operation Shield, right the way through to promises that were made over finance that may or may not have been fully acted upon. It depends who you talk to, I think, and what colour rosette they wear as to whether or not those promises have been fully acted on. But, you know, I think from my point of view, as I said earlier on, we're at the end of a decade where local government, the role of local government, what we do, hasn't been, in my opinion, fully understood and appreciated by central government until now, when, you know, those food parcels would not have got where they needed to get to without local authorities. That the reassurance, the comfort blanket for businesses, and the, you know, in my part of the world, we put out £32 million of business rate relief. Just because central government released that money doesn't mean it ended up on the front line in the banks of those businesses. That took local government, and it didn't just take, you know, revenue and benefits officers to do it. It took an IT team to be able to get applications done online, and then, you know, working with the banks to get the apps turned around in 24 hours. You know, that was a huge logistical challenge that local government has been through, and I don't think that is appreciated, and I don't think that that is properly understood. I've been speaking to Keir Starmer about this, and he totally gets what local government have done during this pandemic, and he wants to I think work with us going forward. And, you know, from my perspective as a Labour politician, Nick Forbes, who is our leader in local government, he now attends the shadow cabinet meeting, which is great because it means that there is another voice of councillors around the table, and I think that's going to be important going forward. In terms of us being able to access the finance, I think what we've seen is that the commercial agenda has failed. So whilst the government have managed to go back to providing grants or providing support, which they have done during this, they have not been able to support us in plugging the loss of income that we have had to do. So whether it's local government finance, whether it's some of this employment, in my view, I've been arguing for a long time, local government finance is being built on quicksand. It is not being built sustainably. Because we're having to close our budget gap. So we're having to take risks. We're having to buy shopping centres, and we're having to buy retail parks. And of course, they haven't survived the test of COVID at all well. And we have lost income, and we still have to provide those statutory services, but we're now not getting that income in because market forces have you know, conspired to mean that no one has done well during this COVID crisis. So the government, I think, has to, if it truly understands the scale of the challenge, I hope that the spending review, at the very least, and if not before, in an economic statement next week, that the Chancellor looks to reinstate the revenue support grant. I hope that, whether that is just for the life of this Parliament, so that we can, use some reserves to offset the impact and kind of take the, take the burden off slightly. I think that would be helpful, but I'm not convinced they're in the mood to listen. If I'm honest, I hope I am wrong, but I think that at the moment there's been lots of warm words, but still there's been people on the front line who've been left behind because there hasn't been the money coming into local government. So let's hope we're given the benefit of the doubt that they do the right thing in the next few weeks, and that they give us some long-term certainty. Councils simply don't know beyond March the 31st next year how much money we have to be able to provide services. I mean, you cannot plan with that level of uncertainty. And we all have to sit here and wait until October, until a spending review, to get some idea, and then turn around plans in just 4 or 5 months before they go to council budgets in February, March next year. It's an awful way to govern. And I hope it changes.
Especially since I'm sure you've got loads of planning that you want to be doing about making sure that people stay in jobs and that those kind of industry and arts and culture are protected, as well as those benefits of community that I think, people have experienced up and down the country, but they've experienced that partly because they were able to reach to the council to kind of say, yes, there is a vulnerable person in my street. Okay, that's not for our mutual aid society. That is, we need to liaise with the council because, if it's just like I've run out of printer paper, then my street can sort me out. But it's not the same with somebody who needs care, for example.
Absolutely. Let's hope that the lessons of 2008 and 2009 have been learned. And let's hope that austerity is never seen as the right answer to recession ever again. I mentioned earlier, I have the fifth most economically unequal borough in the whole of the UK. I have some of my wards where there is up to 40% children living in child poverty. I know what I want to do about that, but it requires interventions over a sustained period of time, and it will not fix itself inside an election cycle. It will take a generation to fix those kind of issues. And so I need to be able to look at my medium-term financial strategy, my 10-year financial strategy, and I need to be able to say, this is what we're going to do in terms of intervention here, there, and everywhere. You need to have that kind of understanding from central government, and then you need to be able to be given the tools to make those longer-term decisions locally.
Everyone I've talked to has that same concern about the money, and it's a real one. But what else do you need, like in terms of support or staying out of the way or information? What do you need to like make this plan come real?
See, now we can get onto my favorite subject, which is local government reorganization. Because who do I need to stay out of the way? Well, Essex County Council would be a start in my part of the world, because I often say this, we're trying to come up with big radical policy solutions and then fit them back into the same governance structures that have failed people for so long. So in my part of the world, we are the second largest district council in the country, population touching on 200,000. Up the road from me in London, they're not a million miles away from that in terms of population in some of these boroughs. And the only indicator that ever comes back is looking at the size of population. I mentioned earlier about the size of Basildon's business rate base. We would be in a really strong position to be able to go forward as a unitary authority. But we can't get over the government's test unless we've got another 100,000 people on our population. So that is a measure of how local government reorganisation should work that doesn't make any sense at this moment in time. People want to understand, they want to have faith in politics, they want a single point of contact for who they can hold accountable for whatever. It is still a ridiculous situation in Basildon that schools, education, public health are not in the control of the local council. They are in the control of the regional council, because with the best will in the world, the people who are making the decisions at County Hall on public health have never been to parts of my borough. And when COVID came along and there was lots of scientific evidence around the propensity of those with underlying respiratory health problems to be worse affected, that put Basildon in a really, really bad place, because in the south of the borough, particularly in the area I represent in Pitsea, our respiratory public health outcomes are not good. And so we've been trying desperately to work in partnership since I became leader on new ways of working when it comes to public health. But I don't have that data. It is not readily available. If you go to the county council and ask to see data just for the Basildon borough, they won't give it to you because it is a north, south, east and west. And again, if you put us in with our next door neighbours in Brentwood, that will massively skew the averages of you know, health outcomes and you know, outcomes in child social care, outcomes in adult social care as well. So for me, we have got to start talking about devolution, and we have to start talking about devolving power to the most local level in a way that actually works. And for some councils, I get it. They're too small to be able to go it alone, and they will need to look at mergings. And in many cases, that makes sense, and I understand it. In some cases, it doesn't make sense, and it can be a huge problem. And you know, Bournemouth, Christchurch and Poole, three very big unitary authorities, and or two unitaries and one district, coming together in that way, that's going to take 10 years before that really flourishes. There are many councils, my own included, that you know, on day one, we would be ready to flourish as a unitary authority, but trying to get that hearing with the government when you are sub 300,000 population is nigh on impossible. And I just think that's nonsense, because, as I say, it should be about the quality of services that are being delivered, not necessarily about how many people live in the borough, especially when you can offset some of the council tax base with a higher business rate base like we can in Basildon.
No, I hear what you're saying. I think you've got a full plate, a lot of ideas and some big challenges ahead. Thank you very much for sharing that with us.
No worries. Thank you.
Yeah, I think Gavin really highlighted the challenges that councils are facing and how councils have risen to those challenges. Of course, he does come from a particular political perspective.
Yes, other political perspectives are available, you should say.
And we've certainly found that politicians from all parties are facing similar challenges and meeting them in similar but locally diverse ways.
Indeed. And I think that point is worth making, because you know, we are seeing on the national stage that the sort of sharp politics are coming back into focus. You know, we're seeing party politics becoming sharper again. You know, more scrutiny and critique of the government's handling of the pandemic. And at the moment, I think that hasn't really kind of manifested locally. Locally, we're still in a fairly consensual space, but what I'm seeing in local authorities is there's not a great deal of political contestation. There's a great deal of goodwill and people working in a very place-based way, and place being more important than party, and people, you know, really coming together to think about how the council changes and how the council serves its residents as we emerge from this, if we're emerging from this, as we get into the next stages of this. It will be interesting to see whether that continues, or whether we see what's happening nationally mirrored locally. I think the decisions about sort of going into lockdown, about sort of the first phases of the pandemic, were tough to do and tough emotionally, but we kind of knew what we had to do. I think get into the next phases of this, there's a great deal more uncertainty. There are a great many more questions, you know, as they say, questions upon which reasonable people might differ. You know, there is no blueprint for this. We you know, everyone's agreed right now that we need to think differently. We need to move forward. We need to build in a different way, you know, sustainable futures, building back better, you know, all the different recovery, all the different phrases people use. As we start getting into the nitty gritty of what that looks like in concrete terms, that's where, and I guess sort of flagging up the future work we're going to be doing this, that's where those issues around bringing communities with you, doing this in a way that people trust, you know, getting the governance right, all of that is going to become more and more important as we move forward.
And I should say, Jonathan, you mentioned that you could sign up for the roundtable on the sustainable future stuff, but also you can sign up on lgiu.org, basically in the same place, for some of our other pillars, our other strands of work. And there will be events around those. There will be other participatory ways that you can engage with us so that we can have those discussions together and bring different perspectives to the table.
Yeah, there'll be an event for each of those. But for now, let's start with, because if we don't do this sustainably, then none of it's worth doing. So do go and have a read of the stuff we're publishing on sustainable futures. Do get in touch with us if you'd like to be part of that. Get in touch with us if you'd like to talk about us, you know, helping with your recovery planning, sharing our experiences, helping you, connecting you with councils who are doing similar things elsewhere. And have a good week. Stay safe.
Thanks for listening.
If you'd like to leave a review of the podcast, please do. Please let us know what you think using your usual podcast provider. And hit subscribe. See you in a fortnight.